All Things Considered is next.
Shooting today at Utah Valley University, where Trump ally and Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk was speaking.
We will bring you updates on the situation.
It's Wednesday, September 10th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Three former senior FBI agents are suing the Trump administration.
They allege that they were fired for refusing to demonstrate loyalty to the president.
That they were let go for no good reason because the boss thought it would be symbolic is stunning.
Also, an update on COVID vaccine accessibility.
How easy is it for those who want the updated vaccine to get it?
And meet the new bachelorette.
Taylor Frankie Paul stars on another reality show, The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives.
It's not real. It's not real. And it's not going to be until I think the limo's pulling up, you know, and I'll be like, meeting the people.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. In a post on Truth Social, President Trump says Charlie Kirk is dead. His death has not been independently confirmed. The conservative activist was shot in the neck during a speaking event today on the campus of Utah Valley University in Orem. The 31-year-old Kirk was the CEO and the founder of the political youth organization Turning Point USA. Emma Pitts is a reporter with Deseret News and witnessed the shooting.
Charlie Kirk, he had just, maybe 10 minutes had started. He was on his second question. And before he could even answer the second question that the interviewer asked, he went to go pick up the mic. And I heard first a sound. It sounded like a firecracker. And then I just saw so much blood come out of the left side of Charlie's neck, and then he went limp. And at that point, we all hit the ground.
NPR's Ryan Lucas has more on what happened.
Kirk was at Utah Valley University for part of his American Comeback speaking tour. Videos posted online show Kirk, who is a vocal supporter of President Trump, speaking outside to a large crowd. He can be seen holding a microphone while he sits in a chair under a small white tent, when a single shot rings out. Kirk grabs at his neck and appears to fall out of his chair. There are screams in the crowd and people begin to flee. The FBI says it is responding and will work with state and local law enforcement partners. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Russia is signaling it did not intentionally launch drones into Poland's airspace. The comments come after Poland and NATO forces and the aircraft downed more than a dozen drones in Polish territory, prompting concerns of a new escalation in the war in Ukraine. From Moscow, NPR's Charles Maines has details.
The Kremlin spokesman said it was up to the defense ministry to comment on the incident with Poland, and eventually it did so. The Russian ministry issued a statement that said no objects on Polish territory were planned for targeting, and suggested falsely that Polish territory was beyond the range of its drones. The statement added the ministry was ready to hold consultations with Poland on the issue. Meanwhile, Russia's top diplomat in Warsaw, chargé de Fair Andrei Ordash, was summoned to the Polish Foreign Ministry. Speaking to Russian media afterward, Ordash said he had been presented with groundless accusations, declaring Russia was absolutely not interested in any escalation with Poland. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
President Trump is appealing a late Tuesday night federal district court ruling that is keeping Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook on the Monetary Policy Board. Last month, Trump said he was firing Cook from the independent central bank, citing what the president said were irregularities in mortgage documents she signed before she was confirmed to that position. Cook is denying any wrongdoing. The president has been pressuring Fed Chairman Jerome Powell and members of the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. From Washington, this is NPR News. The NCAA has banned three college basketball players from ever playing again. This after finding evidence they gambled on their own games or other performances. All three had played together at Fresno State University before one transferred to San Jose State. The bets took place last season. NPR's Becky Sullivan has more.
Last winter, a Nevada sportsbook flagged some suspicious bets on Mikel Robinson, a junior forward at Fresno State. total of $2,200 on the under in points scored, assists, rebounds, and three-pointers in a random January game. Sure enough, Robinson performed below his season averages on all those stats, and the bets hit for a total of nearly $16,000. Upon investigating, officials from the school and the NCAA found that Robinson had gambled on himself and worked with two other players in this bet and others. The NCAA has urged Congress to ban this type of betting on individual college athletes, but proposed legislation has repeatedly failed to advance. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
The Republican majority in the House of Representatives is shrinking by one. This after James Walkinshaw easily won a seat in Congress Tuesday to fill the seat from the late Congressman Jerry Connolly of Northern Virginia, who died earlier this year. Republicans now have 219 seats, Democrats 213. Another special election is scheduled for later this month. Ahead of Thursday's Consumer Price Index report for the month of August, stocks were mixed today. The Dow declined 220 points, closing at 45,490. The NASDAQ added 6, closing at 2186. The S&P had a gain of 19, finishing at 6,532. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Chapter, offering Medicare advice to seniors nationwide and working to find the plans that best fit their needs. Advisors are available by dialing #250 and saying the keyword Medicare Help.
It is 4:06. Thanks for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report. Local news from our region. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Patchy fog late tonight, otherwise mostly clear, lows 49 to 52. More news is next on KAXE.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly, and we open the hour with developing news out of Utah. Charlie Kirk, the prominent conservative media personality and ally to President Trump, was shot today during an event at the Utah Valley University campus in Orem, Utah. President Trump posted this afternoon on social media that Kirk is dead. NPR is working to independently verify that. For more, we turn to Caroline Ballard, who reports for member station KUER and who is in Orem. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, Mary Louise.
What more can you tell us about what happened today?
So we know that Charlie Kirk was speaking outdoors on the campus here at Utah Valley University. About 20 minutes into the event, that was about 10 minutes after noon local time, university officials say a shot rang out from a building about 200 yards from the speaker, and the university believes Kirk was hit. The university says that Kirk was, quote, hit and taken from the location by security. And they now say that a suspect in today's shooting of Charlie Kirk is not in custody yet. In an email to NPR, university spokeswoman Alan Trainer said a person had been detained earlier, but that individual was released. It is still an active investigation. I will say the presence of emergency vehicles here is intense, and I physically see people with tactical gear. So,
okay, right around you. Okay, well, I do want to ask you, what was Charlie Kirk doing at the University of State? What was today's event?
Well, we know he was invited here by a student group, and that this was the first stop of 15 planned American comeback tour events at college campuses around the country. And our reporting says he was talking about political violence when the single gunshot was heard. We have a clip of Charlie Kirk talking about how college students are responding to President Trump's effect on politics. Here he is on stage at a political rally for Trump last October in Duluth, Minnesota.
Never before has conservatism, the ideas of freedom, liberty, American exceptionalism, been so popular on these college campuses.
So we know that Kirk is one of the most influential voices in the GOP, and he's got a popular podcast and video show. It regularly influences policy discussions inside and outside Washington.
Okay, and I can hear noise behind you. You were telling me a little bit about the security that you can see moving around you as you're talking to us. Just tell me more where you are and describe a little bit more the scene.
So I am on campus. We're close to the sports fields here. It's where they initially told media to stage, but we're seeing people coming in just in the last couple of minutes, like I said, in full tactical gear with rifles. It's a hot, windy day here. See mountains in the background, but yeah, we're just a few minutes from where he was speaking. Media looks, besides us, looks like they have left, so we might have to get out of here in a minute.
Okay, well, you stay safe. Go where you need to go. Thank you for getting us updates. I have the feeling we'll be hearing from you as this night proceeds. Again, reporting on the news there that Charlie Kirk was shot in an event today at Utah College. Caroline Ballard with member station KUER. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Maha report on kids' health reveals a divide between what the Make America Healthy Again movement has been pushing for in the way of healthier food and less exposure to pesticides and what steps the administration is committing to take. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports with no mandates to reduce ultra-processed foods or curb chemical use, the strategy has found both critics and supporters.
When the Maha Commission released its first report in May, it raised concerns about exposure to chemicals. It listed a range of chemicals, including PFAS, microplastics, and pesticides, and noted some kids are exposed to alarming levels. The commission says exposure to chemicals is one potential driver of chronic disease. But the new strategy released by Health Secretary Kennedy strikes a different tone, says Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician and professor at Boston College.
This report says almost nothing about toxic chemicals and their effects on human health. It seems like a complete break from what Secretary Kennedy talked about.
When Kennedy was an environmental lawyer, he spoke out frequently against the use of agricultural pesticides and herbicides. During the 2024 campaign, he made statements vowing to ban some agricultural chemicals that were already restricted in other countries. And the Maha movement applauded him. But the Environmental Working Group's president, Ken Cook, says that talk of change is gone, and the final report reflects the influence of pesticide makers.
We have been up against the pesticide industry for 30-plus years, and I know the mark of industry lobbying when I see it.
After the May report was released, which raised concerns about pesticides, farm groups let it be known they were not happy. The American Farm Bureau Federation released a statement from its president saying, quote, "It is deeply troubling for the White House to endorse a report that sows seeds of doubt and fear about our food system and farming practices," and said it shared the goal of improving health in America. And CropLife America, a trade group of companies that make pest management chemicals, said the report included, quote, "misleading and alarming statements about pesticides." The group then compiled 17 recommendations it wanted to see in the final strategy report, including to, quote, "reiterate the robust, respected process used by EPA to review pesticides before and after regulation." Dr. Landrigan and Ken Cook say this is an endorsement of the status quo, not a call for change.
We simply looked at the response from the pesticide industry trade group and compared it to what was in the May report and in this report. And this report really looks like they just took exactly what the pesticide industry wanted.
Cook says the strategy calls for doubling down on the current regulatory framework.
All of the promises that were made during the campaign, pushing hard on this Maha agenda, those promises clearly are not going to be kept.
Meanwhile, the Farm Bureau put out a statement in support of the new Maha strategy. The group's president said, quote, "We appreciate the commission's willingness to meet with farmers, hear our concerns, and develop smart solutions." Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Will two big reality shows be even stronger together? Today, fans of The Bachelorette learned who season 22's leading lady will be. Taylor Frankie Paul, star of The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives, she announced her casting on the Call Her Daddy podcast.
"It's not real. It's not real. And it's not going to be until I think the limo's pulling up, you know, and I'll be like, meeting the people."
This is a crossover that many didn't see coming, and it breaks new ground for the long-running series. Everyone in my group chat has been talking about this, so I wanted to bring in Brittany Luce from our It's Been a Minute podcast to shed some light on some of our biggest questions. Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Juana.
All right, so this casting is really interesting for so many reasons, but I want to start with Taylor Frankie Paul herself. Her life is not very secret after all of these hours of airtime on Hulu, not to mention she's got this massive social media presence. I know a lot about her because I watch the show, but for people who do not, let's just help them get caught up. Who is she?
Okay, so Taylor Frankie Paul, as you mentioned, she is the star of a Hulu reality TV series called The Secret Lives of Mormon Wives. I mean, it's a pretty large cast of women, but the show is definitely based around her. And it's because she knows how to turn up the drama. I mean, part of the reason why that reality show even came to be in the first place is because of a social media confessional video that she posted about relationship drama going on in her set of Mormon wives and moms in both Salt Lake City, where she's based, and also TikTok. They have this loose group called Mom Talk, where they make videos, I guess, about being moms. Sometimes they collaborate with each other. She started Mom Talk, and she posted this confessional video. She kind of blew up their entire social group, and all of that culminated in a reality TV show that she is the undisputed star of.
And now we just know so much about her already. I wonder, is there precedent for casting someone in the Bachelor franchise that we already know so much about? We've already sort of peeled back the curtain on.
Okay, actually, no. I looked into this because I was wondering the same thing. We have never seen fame at this level in the person who's going to be the Bachelorette.
Interesting. I wonder, Brittany, how do you think this could affect casting and the way that the show unfolds when we see that new season of the Bachelorette?
So, okay, having this kind of like cross reality TV kind of casting, even thinking about a show like Traitors. Like Traitors is a show that actually created kind of a second wave of fame for Gabby Windy, who's a former Bachelorette and also a former Bachelor contestant who I liked when I watched The Bachelor. I liked her when I watched The Bachelorette, but it's Traitors, this other reality TV show that really gave her her most recent burst of fame. So I feel like ABC is kind of taking a play out of these other sort of reality show productions books. The other thing I think is that Taylor is somebody who's going to bring the drama. Capital D drama. I mean, this is a woman, you know what I'm saying, who launched her career with one TikTok. And in a matter of just in under 5 years now, she's the new Bachelorette.
Brittany, we cannot have this conversation without talking about the rollout, the way that ABC sort of dropped this news on everyone. And the way that they dropped it was on the very popular podcast Call Her Daddy that's hosted by Alex Cooper. Yes. That seems new to me.
Yeah, that kind of surprised me as well. But I think that there's a lot that went into this decision in choosing Taylor and unrolling this whole thing that tells me that ABC is looking to court a younger viewer. Like, love reality shows are really popular with people in Gen Z. And also, I'm hearing Gen Alpha, like middle school age children, are watching Love Island, A Conversation for Another Time. But, you know, those are the same people, like Gen Z people, are the same people who are listening to and watching Call Her Daddy online. And so I think that it makes so much sense that she would reveal this while talking to Alex Cooper.
Brittany Lewis hosts NPR's It's Been a Minute. Brittany, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to People Powered, KAXE, and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a moment, our daily dose of phenology with John Latimer. John looks back at this date in his Nature Notes. Support comes from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Thank you for choosing KAXE this afternoon. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, September 10th, in 2018, the berries of the three-leaved false Solomon seal are beginning to ripen. The plants don't have a lot of berries, 3, 4, maybe 5, and they're small and round and red, and they look a lot like the berries you might be familiar with that are found on the Canada Mayflower. And the reason for that is they are cousins. The Canada Mayflower is Myanthemum canadensis, and the three-leaf false Solomon seal is Myanthemum trifolia. The three-leaf false Solomon seal is a plant of the swamps. And the berries have little to recommend them. I have tried them, and my initial reaction was, ooh, these are bitter. And they are. They're followed by a tiny amount of sweetness, but not really enough to make me go back for seconds. After tasting one, I decided they can be food for the birds.
NPR comes from this station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Picking up trash, mulching gardens, patrolling metro stations. By now, we know quite a bit about what the National Guard has been up to here in Washington, D.C. What's less clear is how the armed forces writ large feel about this assignment. Now we can get a sense. Last week, internal documents from the National Guard were inadvertently shared with the Washington Post. They included assessments of public sentiment about President Trump's federal takeover of Washington, D.C. Alex Horton covers national security for the Post and joins us now to talk about this. Hi there.
Thanks for having me.
Alex, just start by telling us, what are these documents that you reviewed and who are they typically for?
So this is a daily assessment prepared by National Guard Public Affairs. They measure what news reports are saying about their deployment to Washington, D.C., and they're also gauging the public sentiment about what's being said on social media. And what they are designed for is to gather up the information, summarize it for leaders, just so they have a better understanding of how their mission is being perceived out there by the public.
What were some of the key takeaways from these documents that you and your colleagues at the Post reviewed about the way the public views this deployment?
There's nothing surprising in here, but what's interesting about these documents is it shows how the National Guard is well aware of these discussions that are happening out there. One of the summary slides we got a hold of says, trending videos show residents reacting with alarm and indignation. One segment features locals describing the Guard's presence as leveraging fear, not security, highlighting widespread discomfort with what many perceive as a show of force.
You also touched on some assessments of troop morale as well. Now, as you said, these documents include publicly expressed opinions from people who self-identify as being in the military, not the troops here in D.C. specifically. But what did you learn about how people in the armed forces are feeling about the National Guard's deployment?
Well, I think there's a little bit of nuance to this on how legitimate and how worthwhile it is, depending on who you are and where you are in your career. If you are a young Guard member, there are several benefits unique to the National Guard of going on missions like this that increase your ability to get a VA home loan, that increase the effectiveness of your GI Bill. Mm-hmm. Let's say you've been in active duty, you already have those benefits. You know, you're in the Mississippi National Guard and you're making five figures or six figures at your job, and now you're making $1,500 a month because you're using enlisted pay. That could start to wear on you a little bit. You can see how that could create challenges for families who need childcare. That can create challenges economically for people who have to stay away from their jobs. Now, that's a trade-off. That's what these folks signed up for. They understand there's this balance between their civilian career and their civilian life and their military life. But there is the sense that you want to be doing something worthwhile. And for the National Guard, that often means helping your neighbor when there's a flash flooding or a hurricane or going on a combat deployment.
And I'll just point out that in your article, the National Guard notes that troops have, quote, cleared 906 bags of trash, spread 744 cubic yards of mulch, removed five truckloads of plant waste, cleared 3.2 miles of roadway, and painted 270 feet of fencing. And look, those are not insignificant improvements for people who live in the city, but how does this square with the National Guard's mission?
It doesn't really, at least the traditional missions, right? And people who study civilian-military relations point to this effect that's sort of accelerated in recent years of the National Guard being an easy button for civic problems. And when the Guard becomes like this tool that you're reaching for, on everything, it erodes their mission of being ready and training for contingencies. Like, they are not just the people you call for floods. They are going to Iraq and Afghanistan and going on and serving alongside active duty troops in combat. And then they come home and they respond to hurricanes. So when you start using them in this way, it starts to break down like these very traditional and very rigid rules of how you use military force and where you use military force, and more clearly, how often you use it within the United States. It should be an exceptional thing, and it's becoming a lot more ordinary. And that alarmed some people who follow this closely.
That's Alex Horton, national security reporter at The Washington Post. Thank you so much.
Thank you much.
As the months get cooler and we head into cold and flu season, it's time to get an updated COVID vaccine, too. Things are playing out differently this year, though. It may be harder for some of us to get the shot. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here to explain. Hi, Sydney.
Hi.
Hi. So what's going on? Everybody can just go out and get their COVID shots or not?
Yeah. So some people have been able to, no problem, but many others haven't. And that's because there are a bunch of steps that need to happen. The first step is approval by the Food and Drug Administration, which happened last month. However, FDA narrowed the approval to specific groups: people 65 and older, and people under 65 who have an increased risk for severe illness. And this season, only the Moderna shot is approved for kids between 6 months and 5 years old.
Interesting. So a question relevant to your beat: if the FDA is approving vaccines for fewer people, does that mean the drug companies are making fewer doses?
Yeah, so none of the vaccine manufacturers would give me exact numbers when I asked. But Pfizer, for example, said it was preparing similar volumes as last year and that it's confident that it will meet demand. It also says millions of doses have already shipped. Claire Hannon is the executive director of the Association of Immunization Managers. She says pharmacies are able to order the shots and they've been shipped out.
I think the manufacturers, you know, have a good trajectory. They always produce more than is needed. I don't think supply will be an issue. You know, like, there's plenty of supply.
Moderna and Pfizer both have vaccine finder websites up and running where you can punch in your zip code and see who has the shots near you. The COVID shots Hannon says are not shipping out yet are the ones that are part of the Vaccines for Children program. About half of kids in the U.S. are eligible for free vaccines this way. That delay is because one of the many steps that I mentioned earlier just hasn't happened yet. It's the meeting of a government panel of experts that makes vaccine recommendations, and that won't happen until next week.
And what are we expecting there? Is that panel expected to recommend the vaccines in line with the FDA?
You know, it's not clear. This was the panel of experts that Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recently fired and replaced.
Aha.
And it's important because in 13 states, pharmacists can only administer the vaccines recommended by the panel and endorsed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So right now, people trying to get COVID shots in those states have to get prescriptions from their doctors. But I want to mention another wrinkle in this whole process, and that's whether insurance will cover the shots. Because if they don't, people are looking at paying full price, which could set you back around $200.
And which could make a lot of people think twice. Have insurance companies said what they are going to do here?
Yeah, so UnitedHealthcare and Aetna are both covering them with no cost sharing for patients on fully insured plans. And I said to them, okay, even for a healthy 45-year-old person with no underlying conditions, someone not in that narrower FDA approval that we talked about earlier, and they said, yeah, even for that person, the shot should be fully covered. That said, I'm also hearing from some people who say that they need to self-attest to additional health conditions at the pharmacy to get a shot. Even by saying that they had, you know, a desk job and lived a sedentary lifestyle was enough, but it is a bit of a gray zone now.
NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin, thank you.
You bet.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, national Native news. And 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Beltrami Electric Cooperative, your Touchstone Energy Cooperative, providing energy to keep lights on, coffee hot, and batteries charged, connecting communities and powering life in northern Minnesota for more than 80 years. More at beltramielectric.com. We also thank the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Militici, new music from the old country. Sam Miltich and his friends will take the stage Saturday, September 13th, 7 p.m. Tickets available at the door. More info at edgecenterarts.org. You can see a local food demonstration at the Grand Rapids Farmers Market this Saturday, 10 a.m. Learn how to make apple cabbage salad. There will be a limited number of free ingredient kits available. Thank you for listening to KAXE.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A big win for a First Nation in Ontario. The Supreme Court of Canada has dismissed a request from the town of South Bruce Peninsula to appeal a lower court decision that granted a valuable section of beach to the Saugeen First Nation. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the chief of the band calls the ruling like a breath of fresh air.
In April of 2023, the Ontario Appeal Court granted the First Nation ownership of just over a mile of sandy beach in the town of Sauble Beach. It's been a long fight. The case was brought before the courts 35 years ago, but that came nearly 100 years since Indigenous leaders claimed that a treaty in 1854 gave them ownership of the disputed shoreline. Conrad Ritchie is the chief of the Saugeen First Nation.
That's how resilient and patient our people have been to feel finally heard and seen and validated. You're holding your breath for such a long time, and it's like once you get the noose, it's just like a breath of fresh air.
With the ruling to appeal now denied by the Supreme Court, the town of South Bruce Peninsula and several landowners appear to have exhausted all legal avenues to retain ownership. On Canada Day, the name of the beach was officially changed from Sauble Beach to Saugeen Beach by the First Nation. Here again, Chief Ritchie.
It kind of grooms society. It kind of grooms community. It kind of grooms children when you have a colonial name that's supposed to be the Indigenous people of that land's land and beach.
Now that the legal wrangling over ownership of the land has been decided, the next step is to discuss compensation with the federal government for breaking that 1854 treaty. Meanwhile, Ritchie says Saugeen Beach will continue to be open to the public as a tourist destination. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
This past weekend, roughly 10,000 people converged on Bismarck, North Dakota to drum, dance, and celebrate one of the region's oldest powwows. Senior reporter Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire has the story.
It's going to be a good day here at the United Tribes Technical College International Powwow.
The 55th United Tribes Technical College International Powwow started modestly in 1970. A small group of students held it on a tennis court. But in the years since, it's exploded in scale and magnitude, drawing participants and visitors from all over, including Europe. UTTC President Leander McDonald says it's not only a cultural event, but a huge economic boost to the Bismarck area when combined with several other events like their sports tournaments.
And a previous study indicated $4.2 million for that week. Did another analysis, but we felt it was kind of off a little bit because they told us a million. And so now we're working with the Bismarck Band and Chamber here, and they have some folks that do analysis on just events on their own.
Historically, the UTTC International Powwow was also once the last call before winter, before indoor powwows and those in warmer climes took off. This year's event was covered live by Buffalo's Fire and Prairie Public, a statewide public media broadcast organization. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Bismarck.
A bill to require the California Department of Transportation and Department of Public Health to work together to address countermeasures to deter suicide attempts on bridges and overpasses was sent to the governor's desk on Tuesday. Native American Assemblymember James Ramos introduced the bill as part of broader work to address mental health care in the state. Ramos says California must do more to confront the great tragedy of suicide, adding the new measure is intended to help prevent future sorrow. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Now more than ever, the supporters of this and all Native One programs deserve a little extra love. Learn more about all our public radio underwriters and web-based sponsors at kawanak.org/supporters-spotlight.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features, presenting Downton Abbey, the grand finale, concluding the story of the Crawley family. This motion picture event can be experienced in theaters this Friday. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Three senior FBI agents are suing the Trump administration, arguing they were fired for refusing to demonstrate loyalty to the president. The new lawsuit also lays bare what it claims are internal communications within the Bureau during critical moments this year. NPR's Carrie Johnson is following this. She is here now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi there.
Say a little more about who these agents are and what they are alleging.
There are three highly decorated former FBI agents with a combined 60 years of experience. These are men who help rescue hostages, dismantle street gangs, prevent terrorist attacks. One of them is Brian Driscoll. He briefly served as acting director of the entire FBI this year, but he was fired last month after clashing with the new FBI director, Kash Patel. This lawsuit says Patel wanted him to fire another agent under his command for improper political reasons and without due process. When Driscoll refused, he was fired before he could formally retire and collect his benefits. And another fired agent is Steve Jensen. He led the FBI's Washington field office and helped coordinate the response to the Capitol riot 4 years ago. The third is Spencer Evans, who led the Las Vegas field office until he was fired. And their case says these dismissals break the law, violate the First Amendment guarantee of free speech and association, and the Fifth Amendment protection for due process.
Now, am I right in thinking it would be very unusual for agents, very recently former agents, at this level, these are very senior people, for them to sue their bosses? Why did they feel they needed to take this step?
We have not seen this before. The lawsuit alleges a campaign of retribution from President Trump on down. These court papers say leaders in the White House and the DOJ wanted to see mass firings of people who investigated Donald Trump over the effort to overturn the 2020 election and the FBI search at Trump's Florida property. These three senior FBI agents kind of got caught in the middle. Their lawyer, Abby Lowell, explained it this way.
We need these three kinds of people to lead our law enforcement and our national security, and that they were let go for no good reason because the boss thought it would be symbolic of the promises he made or the revenge he always seeks, is stunning.
He says the FBI has just gotten rid of men with direct responsibility over investigations like the Tesla cyber truck bomb in Las Vegas and the killings at the Jewish Museum in D.C. this year, even as the White House makes crime prevention a priority.
It's so interesting. What is the administration saying about this lawsuit? Have they commented?
The FBI had no comment when I reached out to them a while ago, but the Bureau generally does not talk about personnel matters, and the Justice Department does not usually talk about pending litigation like this either. In the past, the White House has been pretty firm that the president has the power to fire virtually anyone in the executive branch, and that's basically what happened here.
Carrie, may I invite you just to take a step back and talk about how this lawsuit fits or doesn't into broader happenings at the Justice Department and the FBI that you're tracking?
Yeah, court papers in this case say the FBI Director Kash Patel told one of the fired agents that Trump wants to get rid of people who helped investigate and prosecute him, and that he and Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller wanted to see a big shakeup in the workforce, we've seen that kind of disruption across the federal government this year. And one of the notable things about this case is that these fired agents had direct contact with people near the top of the FBI and DOJ, enough to see mistakes and some allegations of petty behavior. For instance, the lawsuit says a top DOJ official got upset with Driscoll because agents were posting videos of Driscoll as Batman, a hero, and the DOJ official as the movie villain Bane.
Wow. So many interesting twists and turns on your beat. NPR's Carrie Johnson. Thank you, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
Throughout President Trump's unprecedented intervention in Washington, D.C.'s affairs, Mayor Muriel Bowser has tried to balance opposing Trump with appeasing him. Her approach has angered some in her political base, and as Trump prepares to give up control of the city's police department and turn his attention elsewhere, other Democratic leaders could soon face the same dilemma. Here's WAMU's Alex Coma.
Since Trump won a second term in office, the D.C. mayor has tried to seek common ground with him where she can. Bowser's ordered the destruction of the prominent Black Lives Matter plaza near the White House, cleared homeless encampments that angered Trump, and smiled for the cameras with him in the Oval Office. A quite different approach from his first term, when she made political hay out of bashing the president. Bowser frames it as a pragmatic approach to ward off additional interference.
It has been clear that our autonomy has kind of been in the crosshairs. That's our North Star.
The federal government exercises outsized control over the city, which has fought for years for self-governance and even statehood. So despite some grumbling, the city's politicians largely supported Bowser to present a united front. But that started to change after Bowser went out of her way to praise Trump's decision to send federal law enforcement agents into the city.
We greatly appreciate the surge of officers that enhance what MPD has been able to do in this city.
Tommy Wells, a former D.C. council member who later worked for Bowser's administration, sympathizes with her precarious position. But he believes such compliance with Trump's directives risk giving him cover to repeat these actions elsewhere.
You have to speak out. Many of us moved to Washington because we believe in our government, we believed in higher purpose, and we believe in public service. You can't just put that all on a shelf now. That's not who we are as a city.
This is a balancing act that's challenged Democrats at all levels across the country. Moderate figures like Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer have pressed for compromise with Trump to keep the government open, but that's outraged a lot of the Democratic base. Zoran Mondani, the Democratic nominee for New York City mayor, is perhaps the best example of a candidate that has channeled some of the party's frustration. Leaders of the left wing of the party, like Senator Bernie Sanders, have pressed for this sort of direct confrontation.
And what Zoran's campaign is about is an understanding that today we are living in an unprecedented moment in the modern history of our country, and we have got to fight back in an unprecedented way.
Many D.C. activists are looking for a similar candidate. Scott Goldstein, a progressive teachers advocate, believes Bowser's approach has put her out of step with voters ahead of next year's mayoral race.
There is a wide open lane for someone to capture the incredible sentiment from the people in D.C. right now that we need a different approach to leadership.
But it's still unclear who, if anyone, might challenge Bowser with a more forceful response to the Trump administration should she seek a fourth term. Should she win, she'd tie Marion Barry for the longest tenured mayor in city history. D.C. Councilmember Robert White ran against Bowser 4 years ago, and he's signaled an interest in doing so again. He's also sharpened his criticism of Bowser in recent weeks.
We should not, as the District of Columbia, be giving people the impression that this is a good thing, that we are okay with it, that it is helping the city. It is not doing any of those things.
Yet White has still not formally announced a campaign, and he faced complaints in his first bid that he failed to draw a clear enough contrast with Bowser. This has fueled calls from some progressive voices for a more forceful candidate to jump in, and fellow councilmember Janice Lewis-George could fit the bill. Since winning office with the backing of Democratic Socialists 5 years ago, she's been among the mayor's chief antagonists, including on her approach to Trump.
We've never seen in history where complying in advance or capitulating has worked. The only response has to be reject and to resist. And in doing so, we earn allies across this country in this fight.
As the emergency takeover of the city's police department ends tonight, the president could eye interventions in other cities, presenting similar tests for other Democratic leaders. For NPR News, I'm Alex Coma in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered on KAXE. It is 4:44. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories produced by Ampers, news stories from communities throughout Minnesota. Support for KAXE comes from the 17th Annual Community Connect, Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing information on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. More info can be found by dialing 211. We also thank the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Patchy fog late tonight, otherwise mostly clear, lows 49 to 52, and tomorrow widespread fog early, then mostly sunny. Chance of rain in the evening. Highs tomorrow 71 to 74.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
the state secures federal funding for education. Then, what is in our food? Why lawmakers are banning some popular food dyes? And a new renewable energy project gets the green light. I'm Gracie J. Minnesota Attorney General says his office has secured an agreement requiring the federal government to release the full balance of education funds that had been frozen. The Trump administration withheld $74 million from Minnesota and hundreds of millions nationwide, affecting after-school programs, teacher preparation, and support for English learners. The state attorney general and a coalition of states sued, calling the freeze unlawful. Under the agreement, the administration will release the remaining money by early October, and both sides have moved to dismiss the lawsuit. The Attorney General's office says it will keep fighting if the feds try and withhold funds again in the future. Next, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and some Minnesota lawmakers want to ban a popular food additive. Producer Britt Ahmet tells us why.
Mary Beth Gilsdorf kept waiting for her daughter to age out of her tantrums.
We went through the terrible twos, and then what I consider the worst threes. But then we got to four and it was like, wow, this is really still not getting better. And then we got to school.
Like many parents, this mom from Northwest Minnesota hit the internet trying to figure out what was going on.
A lot of the symptoms I was Googling, it kept coming up with, oh, ADHD. I know that's not my daughter.
Then around 2003, when her daughter was six, she heard about a connection between artificial dyes used in foods and behavioral issues with kids. She decided to weed them out of their diet. It couldn't hurt.
For a week, it didn't take very long, but the difference was overwhelming. My example was we had dinner one night and she spilled milk. My husband and I, and even our younger daughter, the whole table just held our breath because that was the kind of thing that would set off a night of tantrums and tears. And instead, my daughter paused and said, I'll go get a rag and I'll clean that up.
The idea that artificial food dyes could impact health was a movement slowly gaining exposure until April 2025, when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration declared an intention to phase out six synthetic dyes by the end of next year. Minnesota-based General Mills promised to remove the dyes from its U.S. cereals and K-12 foods by next summer. Europe and California have already banned the dyes, and some Minnesota lawmakers have proposed a bill that would do the same.
We're all on board for that.
Dr. Joanne Slavin is a professor in the University of Minnesota's Department of Food Science and Nutrition. She says there's no reason artificial food dyes, which are petroleum-derived chemicals, need to be in our food supply when natural alternatives are available. But she worries about fast-tracking their removal.
We go in and make these policies that aren't practical for the people that have to feed the world. You know, whether you're at school lunch or a hospital or your family.
To her, food security is the more pressing issue. A hasty ban could impact food availability to schools, food shelves, shelters, and the SNAP food assistance program. She also adds that the ban isn't a magic bullet. Artificial colors tend to be found in
what we could call junk foods in the past or ultra-processed foods.
Those prepackaged shelf-stable goodies that can contain loads of sodium, sugar, saturated fats, and preservatives. Still, removing the artificial colors is a good step forward for Mary Beth Gilsdorf, who, over 10 years ago, created the Facebook group Dye-Free Kids to give another space for families who wanted to ask questions and share knowledge.
It's overdue. It adds nothing nutritionally or health-wise, and not all kids are affected by it, but the ones that are, it's very impactful.
This is Britt Amit for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission has approved a site permit for the Snowshoe Energy Storage Project, the state's first standalone battery storage facility. Located in Olmsted County between Byron and Rochester, the 150-megawatt project will store excess electricity for up to 4 hours and release it during high-demand periods. Officials say it will help smooth energy fluctuations and support more renewable power on the grid. The battery energy storage systems must coordinate with local governments and emergency responders on water main plans, emergency equipment, and training, all at the company's expense. The facility is expected to be online by late 2027.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Conservative activist and Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk is dead. His organization confirmed his death this afternoon on social media. Kirk was shot during an event at Utah Valley University in Orem, Utah. The shooter is still at large. Our co-host Scott Detrow spoke to Deseret News reporter Emma Pitts, who was an eyewitness to the shooting.
This is Emma Pitts with Deseret News.
Hey, Emma, it's Scott Detrow with NPR. How are you?
I'm doing as well as I can. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks for agreeing to talk to us. Are you in a place where we can just roll and have the conversation and let you get back to your reporting?
Yeah, of course. It is loud. We were kicked out of the building, so there are helicopters everywhere and police, but
okay.
I'm in as quiet as a place as I can be.
Okay, and I appreciate you doing this, and I appreciate the challenge of reporting in a situation like this, and thank you.
Then Pitts walked Scott through what she saw.
So Charlie Kirk, he had just, I mean, maybe 10 minutes had started. He was on his second question. And before he could even answer the second question that the interviewer asked, he went to go pick up the mic. And I heard first a sound. It sounded like a firecracker.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just saw so much blood come out of the left side of Charlie's neck. And then he went limp. And at that point, we all hit the ground. But again, it was such a positive atmosphere. I think there were so many college students. Everyone just seemed so happy to have Kirk there, I think. And there weren't too many protesters either.
So that was my question. There wasn't tension beforehand, as far as you could tell, or at least not in a really notable way?
No, I mean, he made kind of a jokey comment because there was... So we were kind of in this bowl area where he was at the base of it. And then there were steps that people were standing and sitting on. And yeah. It just gradually went higher and higher. And then there were people at a balcony above Kirk. And there were protesters there. There was a pride flag and some signs.
Mm-hmm.
But again, we told our editors, there's maybe 10, 15 protesters here.
And how big was the crowd roughly?
Oh, my gosh. I feel like there were so many people. Probably, I don't know how many people. Maybe 300.
Was there security in the event? Were there metal detectors or anything like that?
No. And I mean, we were given tickets. We all signed up for tickets, but there was no process to go through that. No bags were checked. It's all in a public space at the university.
Okay.
And I did take note of that. That was kind of...
So there wasn't any sort of way to screen in a serious way or a casual way for weapons?
No, there wasn't. I mean, his security was there, and I did see a few police officers behind his tent, but again, not a heavy security presence.
Obviously, this is all unfolding. There's a lot of confusion in a moment like this. What can you tell us about what people are saying, what you're seeing now in the aftermath of this on the site?
Just absolute tragedy. I have strangers coming up to me asking if I can hug them all the time. There's still people here just so horrified by what they had to see. And I think everyone is so upset and brokenhearted, and we're all praying for his family and for him.
That's Emma Pitts, a reporter with Deseret News. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Emma Pitts, as you heard, speaking with our co-host, Scott Detrow.
Seventy-five years ago this month, Beverly Cleary's first novel was published.
Henry Huggins was in the third grade. His hair looked like a scrubbing brush, and most of his grown-up front teeth were in.
Henry Huggins launched Beverly Cleary's career as the author of such best-selling children's books as Ramona and The Mouse and the Motorcycle. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, that first Henry Huggins story was a simple chapter book about an adventurous kid, but it also included a moral dilemma.
Beverly Cleary was inspired to write Henry Huggins because of what she heard from kids when she was working as a children's librarian. As she told NPR in 1999,
boys particularly ask, where were the books about kids like us? And there weren't any at that time.
I guess they've been reading, you know, about cowboys and astronauts and scientists.
Joe Bonomo has written books about rock music. He's also an English professor at Northern Illinois University. He got hooked on Henry Huggins growing up in Wheaton, Maryland in the 1970s.
He was cool.
And not, he says, in the conventional sense of the word.
He was kind of a loner, but not in a bad way or in a sad way. He made his own entertainment.
Henry liked to go to the pet store.
Henry would wander around by himself looking for ways to spend his allowance.
Best of all, Henry liked the fish.
And that's exactly what I did on my allowance walks. I went to Wheaton Newsstand, then I went to a magic shop, and then I went to a fish store. So there's all these kind of neat ways that I identified with him.
The book was definitely of its time. Henry and his neighbors are white and middle class, and more than once he dresses up as a, quote, Indian. Even so, it has never gone out of print. Henry's most important relationship in the book is with his dog, who he meets one day when he's eating an ice cream cone and notices a stray staring up at him.
The dog was hungry. When Henry licked, he licked. When Henry swallowed, he swallowed.
Henry adopts the dog, names him Ribsy, and the two become inseparable.
And they have multiple adventures together until the climax of the novel, which is one that made me think a lot about the meaning of things.
Michael Derda is a Pulitzer Prize-winning literary journalist and columnist for The Washington Post. He says Beverly Cleary's books taught him to read. He has vivid memories of the last chapter of Henry Huggins called Finders Keepers. One day, while Henry and his friends are playing on Klickitat Street, an older boy they've never seen before rides up on his bike and asks which one of them is Henry Huggins. When Ribsy sees the boy, he starts running towards him. The boy calls the dog Dizzy.
A terrible thought came to Henry. Ribsy must have belonged to the boy before he found him in the drugstore over a year ago.
The older boy isn't angry or mean. He just wants his dog back.
They're all good characters, the young man, the dog, Henry. They've all tried to do the right thing, but the dog has a moral dilemma as much as a person. He has to choose between two different masters, both of whom love him.
The kids decide to let the dog choose which boy gets to keep him with a contest. We won't give away who wins, but for Michael Derda, the tension was a revelation.
And it was at that point that I started to recognize that books were not simple stories with always these Disney kind of happy endings where everything works out perfectly for everybody and no one's hurt. That in fact, life is much more complicated and you have to live with uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity.
75 years later, Beverly Cleary's very first novel is still praised for its simplicity and clarity. It was so popular after it was published in 1950, she wrote five more Henry Huggins books. The stories also featured a minor character who ended up an even bigger star than Henry. Beverly Cleary gave his mischievous neighbor, Ramona Quimby, a series of her own. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It is just before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984, performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at Dale's Auto Body.